This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a woman who spent years behind bars following a wrongful conviction.
It's a roller coaster ride of emotions, but if you know in your heart that you were innocent, you never give up. You never stop fighting. I don't care if it takes your last breath. You keep pushing forward.
She's since been exonerated and talks about the issues that come with missing out on so much. Statistics show a big drop across the country when it comes to abortions, but Illinois' decline has been much smaller. What's behind the numbers? The Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois is a popular spot for nature enthusiasts, but some of the locations inside the forest could soon cost money to visit.
In some ways, I consider it more fair, because if you're the one utilizing it, you're the one who's one in need of those facilities, and two, you're impacting those facilities.
That and more on this week's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear about a plan that could result in paying money to see some of the natural wonders at the Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois. We'll visit one of the poorer school districts in the state, hear how that's impacting kids. And is Illinois becoming a haven for abortions in the Midwest? What the numbers show. That and more on this week's Statewide. First up this week, Christine Bunch was only 22 years old in 1996 when she was wrongfully charged with the murder of her 3-year-old son Anthony, who died in a house fire in Indiana. She was exonerated in 2012 after serving 17 years out of a 60-year sentence. Bunch visited Illinois and spoke with our reporter Daisy Contreras about the journey to proving her innocence, reconnecting with another son, and educating others about wrongful convictions.
All of this began in 1995 at your home in Decatur County, Indiana. You were only 21 then. There was a fire at your home where you lost your 3-year-old son, Anthony. Give me a little bit of what happened next.
Well, I mean, at first I didn't realize that they were going to say it was an arson and that I was going to become the suspect. But about 2 hours after the fire was out, they were at the hospital telling me that it was an arson. And they wanted a list of all my family and friends. So they essentially just isolated me from everyone. And in that time, I didn't realize that they were going to make a case against the only other person that was there.
Tell me, how did the people investigating pinpoint you as the person who caused all of this and not say that maybe this was an accident?
Well, in 1995, they were still going off of old forensics. So science investigation had grown, but it hadn't caught up to all the smaller counties. So at that time, they walked in and they saw what they termed a pour pattern, which was just a pattern on the floor that came in from the front door, and some other myths that have since been, you know, misconstrued, concrete spalling, blistering, those kind of things. And in their training, those were indicators of arson. So for them, they didn't look any further. They had the indicators, and they decided it was an arson.
And during this time, you were also pregnant. You had just lost a baby. What was going through your mind?
I mean, I think you're just in shock. You don't realize what's happening until all of a sudden you're slammed in the face with it, and you realize, oh, my God, this just happened. This just happened because everything's been wiped out, tore away from you. And you're devastated in that moment. So there's no way to really focus on everything that's happening around you.
How are you putting the pieces back together now? You left prison, and the child that you had while you were there is now an adult. How do you make up for the lost time?
You can't. There's absolutely no way. We did a lot of counseling together to try to work on a relationship, because he felt like I wanted him to go back and be little again so that I could see it. And in a lot of ways, I did, but it comes to a place where you need to accept that you're never going to get that back. And I need to concentrate on what I have with him right now. And I'm glad that, you know, at 23, he calls me a friend and I get to meet his girlfriends and hear what's going on, and I can't ask for more.
Let's talk about the time that you spent in prison. You earned 2 degrees while you were waiting. Looking back, what encouraged you to pursue that or to have motivation to do anything?
There are a number of people in prison that are just sitting stagnant. And I didn't want to just do nothing and say, where did the time go? I wanted to make every moment count, even if I had to be there.
Earlier, we were talking about you giving presentations. So you're all about educating others and bringing your experiences to different groups of people. And in particular, one group is cops. What has been your experience? What are you, you know, what is the purpose of your presentations? And what are the reactions when you do talk to people like law enforcement?
Ooh, well, my reaction at first was not very good. But it really led me into part of the presentation, which I think is impartial bias. And we're all humans, so we all have some kind of bias towards another person, or we look at a situation and we think, what would I do? And we expect the other person that's in that situation to have done what we would have done. If we are aware of it, then we can separate that and take a look at just this situation without bringing our personal thoughts and our personal beliefs and feelings into it. I think that would stop a lot of wrongful convictions before they ever go down that road. It's still not easy, but it's been very healing, which surprised me. I didn't think that I would look forward to going and talking to cops. But after meeting them, and so many of them come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I get it and I understand. And one young man walked up to me and said, for the rest of my life, I'm not going to forget a single thing about you. And that touched me more than any presentation I've ever done. And when I walked out, it was very emotional, but I felt better the next day. And so I hope to alleviate some of those lines between the wrongfully convicted and law enforcement, because we shouldn't come out and live in fear of these people, because it's not every cop that's bad. It's just a few, and some of them just make honest mistakes.
Speaking of healing and the process to accepting what happened, have you forgiven or moved past, you know, the people who worked on your case and made that mistake?
On a good day, I would say that there is some level of forgiveness there. Most days, I'm not there. I can't ever be there because someone falsified a report and stole those years from me, stole them from my family, stole them from my child. So for me, I know if I was in a job and I made a mistake, I would be held accountable for it. It makes no sense to me that we have law enforcement experts, we have blood spatter experts, fire science experts, all these people that are experts, and we don't hold them accountable when they make a mistake.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras. Today I'm joined by Christine Bunch, an Indiana woman who spent 17 years in prison for a crime she did not commit. In 2012, she was able to walk out of prison and have the murder charge dropped. Christine, when you talk to others that have been in your situation, what kind of support do you offer them? What do they offer you?
I mean, it's shared understanding that you won't get from anybody else in the world. Those are the people that know what it's like to watch all of your people grow and change on the outside. You have a hard time keeping up with them. So everything that you lost, it's compounded and magnified because people have married and died and given birth and grown up, and you've lost out on all of that. And you can't really explain that to your family because it hurts them that you feel like you don't know them anymore, or you don't understand them, or you've grown apart. And with other exonerees, they get that. So you have that family bond because of the shared experiences.
Did you ever expect a solution or resolution to your case? How did you find help, or did help find you? What was the story behind that?
Well, I did what every person in the prison does. I wrote letters every single week, and I wrote to the Innocence Projects, and some of them told me they didn't take cases like mine, and other ones told me they didn't have the time, the staff, or the funds right then. So I continued to write letters just hoping that somebody was going to help, and I befriended a pregnant girl in there. I brought her out cookies, and she introduced me to her attorney. And she was unique because I gave her my savings, and every month, I mean, I got paid a dollar a day. I worked three jobs a day. Every month, I sent her out $50 or $60, and she worked off of that. And then other volunteers come on, and eventually the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University, which is part of the Innocence Network, came on and took over my case.
How long did that take, that fight?
It was 2002 before I got an attorney. It was 2006 before the Center on Wrongful Convictions came on. And it was until 2012 when I walked out.
What would you say is your message to people who are going through the same thing that you did, that maybe they still haven't seen a resolution, or, you know, maybe they feel like they won't see anything happen?
It's a roller coaster ride of emotions, but if you know in your heart that you were innocent, you never give up. You never stop fighting. I don't care if it takes your last breath, you keep pushing forward, and I know that it is very hard, but eventually something opens.
In the 20 years since all of this happened, do you believe that we're headed in the right direction when it comes to investigating cases?
I do believe we're headed in the right direction. Of course, you know, this administration got rid of our Forensic Science Council, and I believe that was a mistake because we need to focus on forensics, especially when it comes to women's cases, because 9 times out of 10, they were a case like mine, and no crime actually was committed. But those women are so vulnerable in that moment that they can paint a picture and get a jury to believe anything, whether it's true or not. So I think our emphasis really needs to be on forensics pushing forward. I think we need that commission back, and we need to strive to, rectify every mistake we possibly can, because we still have the death penalty. We're still killing innocent people. And in a country that's supposed to be the land of the free, we shouldn't have that.
Christine, thank you so much for sharing your story with me today.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Christine Bunch was exonerated in 2012. She served 17 years in prison. She spoke with our Daisy Contreras. The neediest schools in Illinois saw a boost in their revenue this year, but it's not enough. Some districts are located next to schools with thousands more dollars to spend on students. And as Lee Gaines reports, the inequity can cause anxiety for students in poorer schools.
19-year-old Juliana Quintana was last year's valedictorian of her high school in Depew, a tiny Illinois village.
It's small. And everyone pretty much knows everybody.
Depew is southwest of Chicago. A majority of its roughly 1,700 residents are Latinx. And the village's claim to fame is a high-speed boat race on Lake Depew every summer. Quintana has spent most of her life here in Depew. She's had to balance school and work because she can't rely on her parents to help her pay for college.
I'm self-funded, and I've always worked two jobs.
Quintana is a first-generation student at Lake Forest College in Illinois. She worries she won't succeed because she says she didn't have advanced placement or foreign language classes in high school. And that's because the Depew School District is one of the poorest in the state.
And I feel like that will really affect me in college. I'm scared to go to college and fail.
The Depew School District has about 430 students. Kindergartners through high school seniors share one building, and most of the students are Latinx, and most are also low income.
So this is our teacher's workroom for elementary.
The school district's principal, Susan Bruner, takes me on a tour of the school building with Quintana.
I hate to show you this even. I'm embarrassed to show you, but I want to come in and just paint their bathroom and
Quintana and Bruner say Depew has a bad reputation among the other wealthier school districts in the area.
There's nothing substantiating that in any way other than, it is economically depressed,
and the Superfund site.
The Superfund site. DePue is polluted by heavy metal toxins from a zinc smelting facility that closed in 1990. That's made for low property values, so the school district receives little in local tax money, and most of the district's funding comes from the state. Still, DePue receives only about half of the money it needs to offer a quality education, according to Illinois' school funding formula.
We had 143 districts that were spending less than 60% of what they needed to spend to meet the needs of their kids. I would argue that's immoral.
That's Robin Staines. She's the president of Advance Illinois, a nonprofit that advocates for increased investment in public education. DePue and many other needy districts have received more money this year because of the state's new funding formula. But Staines says at least half of Illinois districts, including DePue, still have less than 70% of the funding they need.
That can be as much as $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a kid, less than what they need. We still got a lot of work to do.
Rebecca Sebelia says state officials should look to change school district boundaries as a solution.
School district borders are acting as critically divisive lines in our country.
Sebelia is the founder and CEO of EdBuild. The national nonprofit recently published a report that highlights nearly 1,000 divisive school district boundaries in the country. These are boundaries where schools with a majority of students of color, like DePue, on one side, receive far less money than schools with mostly white students on the other side, like Putnam County Community Unit School District 535.
There's a whole lot of wealth that is sitting in a lot of communities in Illinois.
Like Putnam, south of DePue, across the Illinois River. Putnam schools receive about $3,000 more dollars per student than DePue. Sebelia recommends redrawing school district boundaries so that places like DePue have access to more local tax dollars.
It's putting almost an unrealistic burden on the state to try to come up with money to keep up with the Joneses.
But Sebelia knows that redrawing school district boundaries is a tough sell politically. Meanwhile, Illinois' lawmakers made good on their promise this year to increase funding for public education and send those dollars to the neediest schools like DePue. But even with the extra funding, the gap between the haves and have-nots remain. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Just ahead, some FFA students from Illinois want to change how people think about that organization. You're listening to Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the U of I releases recommendations for handling sexual harassment on campuses. We'll have reaction to that. And an art exhibit now in Illinois featuring work from a Syrian refugee camp. Those stories and more on the way. But next, a Northern Illinois FFA chapter is ranked in the top 10 in the country and headed to the national conference. The students are also trying to make people rethink what the organization is and who's it for. Peter Midland has details.
It's late afternoon and the sun is setting over the fields next to Central High School in Burlington. Inside, four students stand at the front of the classroom. Their advisor hits the stopwatch on his phone and they launch into their presentation.
And today we're excited to tell you about the story.
They've been working
the
on this
Burlington
since before
FFA
school
chapter.
Started.
Each story builds upon one another and began to further define us as a chapter.
There are still a few kinks to work out, but in only a few weeks, they'll don their famous blue corduroy jackets and give this presentation on stage in an auditorium at the FFA National Convention. They're nominated for the Model of Excellence Award. That means they're in the top 10 of more than 8,000 chapters in the country. Sophomore Sophia Battaglia is one of those students.
It's like mood swings, pretty much, where it's like, that's awesome, I'm going to national conventions. Like, oh, I'm going to national convention.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know my parts yet, and we only have this many days.
That's why these students, like junior Eric Metz, are here on a Thursday night.
I don't think I've ever studied for something so hard.
Yeah.
I don't study.
The presentation must be 15 minutes, and it covers all of the events and community service the chapter worked on over the past year. And it helps that Central's chapter is growing. So says one of their advisors, Buddy Haas.
So we did have 158 students in the program, and then this year for the 2019-2020, we're right around 220 kids in the chapter in the program.
And Central is right outside of the Chicago suburbs. But Haas says growth is not just happening in the suburbs and in rural communities.
Seeing the growth of just urban students and urban high schools getting ag programs and FFA is really interesting. And so it's helping kind of shift the dynamic of what ag education and FFA is.
That's important to the students. When asked about misconceptions people have about FFA, the group erupts.
Literally today.
Eric pounds on the table.
Oh, he's missing Halloween for his farmers convention. I'm like, all right, FFA is more than just farming. It broads it goes into everything agriculture related. It's not just farmer convention.
Eric's dad is a farmer, but that's not the case for most people in this chapter or in FFA in general. According to the Illinois State Association FFA, only about 10% of members come from farming families. He even asks one of his fellow FFA officers, Junior Amy Hernandez.
Have you ever been on a farm?
No.
No. You don't have to be.
I've never grown a plant.
Can't keep up
I've tried and it dies within like 2 weeks. So, I mean, yeah, but that's definitely a big misconception.
Aside from the misconceptions, the students spoke about the opportunities FFA has given them. It's those opportunities that got their advisor, Buddy Haas, into teaching. He actually wasn't a part of FFA in high school because they didn't have a program.
Really, FFA is the reason why I became a high school ag teacher. And the cool part with the regional program we have set up now is that I have the opportunity, hopefully in the future, to even teach kids from my alma mater through District 303 when they start joining our program here in the next couple years.
And Haas understands many students come into ag classes skeptical, and he has to try to win them over. Some of those skeptical students are even officers now. That includes Ashley Walker.
I tried to get out of intro to ag and go into another science class, and I couldn't change it, and it was God's plan.
It helps that a lot of social issues and careers dovetail into agriculture. Major laws like hemp production to global issues like climate change all have roots in ag.
I tell the students a lot, by 2050, the world's demand for food is going to double, and we got to figure out how we can feed that world. And so having an ag class, I tell them, I say it's not just about farming, it's about if you like wearing clothes, if you like eating, like going places, that's ag.
The group is going to the national convention at the end of October. The chapter has never been in the top 10 before, and by the time they leave, they could be number one in the nation. I'm Peter Medlin.
The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign released a much-anticipated report last week with recommendations to improve the handling of sexual harassment cases involving faculty. But as Rachel Otwell reports, change is not inevitable, and students still want buy-in.
My copy, because it might just...
Robin Carr, law and philosophy professor at UIUC, is sitting in his office flipping through the 127-page report the committee he headed put together.
All of this has been a cultural and environmental learning situation where people have begun to understand better the full nature of the harms.
Recommendations include expanding the definition of sexual harassment beyond the campus's current standard, hiring more confidential advisors to advocate for victims, and asking candidates for university jobs to waive confidentiality of disciplinary records. There are various avenues for approval, but whether the university's Board of Trustees will embrace change remains to be seen.
The last statutory changes that were approved by the board were in 2013, so it happens very rarely.
The hurdles to reducing sexual harassment in higher ed were on display at a recent summit hosted at UIUC. Panelists noted that many people never report incidents to Title IX offices, which are responsible for investigating sexual misconduct complaints. They also raised concerns about how effective Title IX training is and the need to intervene earlier to stop bullying or other problematic behavior.
We need to focus less on the policies and more on the conduct.
That's Christina Larson, an attorney who represents targets of sexual abuse and a panelist at the summit. Larson says in university settings, administrators don't have the same amount of power as they do in the corporate world, and colleagues often have as much power as administrators to intervene.
It doesn't matter whether it's illegal or not. What's ethical? What's appropriate?
A university spokesperson declined to speculate on when the reforms would be adopted or how much they could cost, but says the institution is committed to building a safer community. Here's Chancellor Robert Jones.
It was critically important that we work
very hard and diligently to create a set of policies and practices that would really help us drive home the core message of intolerance of sexual harassment.
Jones says he and the provost are talking with stakeholders about revision and implementation. Calls for change at UIUC began a year ago at a Me Too forum at the College of Law. An audience member asked about reports of harassment by a law professor and what was being done to protect students. In August, an NPR Illinois and ProPublica investigation detailed allegations against several professors in recent years. It uncovered three previously unreported cases where professors were found in violation of university policy and were given periods of paid leave and the chance to resign.
Yeah, so during the consideration of new business, there's a period for technical...
A day after the Faculty Sexual Misconduct Committee's report came out, the university's Student Government Association convened. Sudar Shana Rao, a senior member who also heads the campus organization Students Against Sexual Assault, says student leaders wrote a letter asking to participate in the negotiations after reading the NPR Illinois ProPublica investigation.
So I think the next steps going forward are to keep this momentum going. And the student voice is so, so important. We have the most to lose if the administration or higher powers choose to abuse their power.
She still wants a seat at the table as talks of the committee's recommendations continue. I'm Rachel Otwell.
That report is a collaboration between NPR Illinois and ProPublica's local reporting network. The national abortion rate has dropped. Over a recent six-year period, it fell 20%. But in Illinois, the decline was much smaller, just 2%. Experts say that's because Illinois is an island for reproductive rights in a sea of restrictive states. Maureen McKinney has the story.
Cynthia Buckley says as an Illinois taxpayer, she's irked each time she runs across a billboard beckoning Illinoisans to move to Indiana.
We are footing the bill for their denial of women's rights, and that's not fair.
A sociologist and demographer at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, she's working on a project that shows while the number of abortions among Illinois residents is on the decline, those for women coming into Illinois from out of state has risen sharply. In fact, the number of Illinois residents having abortions is below the national average, she says. The information is based on statistics from the Illinois Department of Public Health and the reproductive rights organization, the Guttmacher Institute. It compiled information indicating that the abortion rate nationally in 2017 is the lowest it's been since the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which ruled that state bans on abortion were unconstitutional. Illinois has expanded its abortion rights, including state-paid abortions through Medicaid. Meanwhile, its neighbors, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, and Kentucky, enacted new restrictions like mandatory ultrasounds and requirements on waiting periods and counseling. They also limit the number of weeks at which a pregnancy can be terminated. Illinois countered with a new law this spring that makes abortion a fundamental right and requires new insurers to cover abortions if they cover pregnancy. Cynthia Buckley says while the states can put in restrictions, abortion is still a right.
We have highways and buses and trains and rural roads that do enable women from surrounding states where abortions are very difficult to acquire. They come to Illinois.
They come by the thousands, she says. Scholars we talked to for the story saw several reasons for the overall drop in abortions. Most pointed to better contraceptives, improved insurance through the Affordable Care Act to cover birth control, and a trend in teens choosing to delay having sex until a time when they are more likely to use birth control. But there remains a disagreement about whether anti-abortion efforts and the increase in restrictions have played a role. Elizabeth Nash is with Guttmacher, which maintains that the restrictions are not the reason for the national overall decline in terminations of pregnancies.
Abortion restrictions do have an impact in some states, certainly on the individual level, where, you know, a restriction, can delay a person from accessing abortion services, make it more difficult to access abortion services, and those burdens aren't necessarily showing up in the rates.
Logically, she said, if the restrictions explain the drop in abortions, birth rates would increase, and they haven't. Others see it differently. That includes Michael New, a business professor at the Catholic University of America, who published articles in both scholarly and commercial publications about abortion trends.
We've seen abortion numbers fall everywhere, even states that are not passing a lot of pro-life laws. So it's not just restrictions, but I do think there's a good body of research that shows that some pro-life laws do reduce abortion rates.
He said there's been a lot of research showing that when you stop taxpayer funding of abortions, abortion numbers go down.
I did a study in 2016 on the federal Hyde Amendment, which limits the ability of the federal government to pay for elective abortions through Medicaid, and I found it has prevented over 2 million abortions since 1976. So again, I do think some pro-life laws are playing a role.
That's what angers Buckley, the University of Illinois researcher.
We are literally and figuratively footing the bill for women's health care in states like Missouri and Iowa and Indiana. Basically, we are a great state in a really bad neighborhood for women's reproductive rights.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
A new traveling exhibit showcasing artwork by Syrian refugees living in a Jordanian camp is now open in Springfield. Rehab Sawa is a physics professor at Lincoln Land Community College and brought the artwork from Jordan. She says the paintings and drawings capture the hopes and dreams of those displaced by the Syrian war. The artist used canvas cut from tents for their work. Daisy Contreras talked with Sawa about the artists who live at the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan.
Some of these are trained as artists, so they went to the university to study arts in Syria. And some of them are professionals who've studied other careers. One of them is an economist. One studied media and Arabic literature. They come from different walks of life. They come from different cities and towns. They just basically represent a collage of what different people and their experiences are like in these homes and towns, cities.
You said the title or the name of the exhibit, Stamps of Hope, was given to you by the artists themselves. What other message did they want to send?
They really stress the message of peace, and to them that takes priority because they see art as a messenger and a messenger that carries the message of peace. That's what one of the artists told me. You can't sit down in front of a campus and paint anything unless you are at peace with some parts of you that allow you to even sit down and be composed enough to carry the brush and start painting. I understand how much they stress the message of peace, and they have a vision of a future that would include new hopes and dreams for their children. A lot of them have children, and they want their children to have a brighter future.
By just looking here and coming in, I noticed artwork of faces. Do they represent somebody in the artist's lives, or is it self-portraits? Tell me a little bit more about the faces that we see reflected on the artwork.
When people live in a refugee camp, they live within very close proximity to one another. And so the faces are everywhere around the instant someone steps outside from their living space. They can see the children sitting in front of the tents or playing. A child who's been displaced from home has lost a part of themselves, and that shows in their eyes. For example, the image that has the little girl who had to flee her home, and she left her bird pet behind. And you can see it in her eyes that she is very sad, but to me, the pet is a piece of herself that she left behind, something she was very passionate about that no longer is accessible to her, and it's very well portrayed in her eyes. The images of faces are, I think that's what draws people in, and they really portray the eyes very nicely in the sense that you can't help but feel as if you are standing in front of the human being itself and you're drawn to come closer.
What message do you personally want to bring to the college here, but also the community at large here in Springfield and in surrounding areas by bringing this to us?
Mm. This is a quote that I sent our gallery director to. He wanted to print this and add it as a decoration to this exhibit. And I always think that art touches our humanity in the most gentle and tender ways, in very peaceful ways. And so this is my message, is that I want people to come out and view this exhibit and not just see it with their eyes, but to experience it with their hearts. because there is something in it that will touch them and transform a part of them. And to have a sense of how we share so much as human beings across the world that is far more greater and more significant than our differences.
You can find more about the Stamps of Hope exhibit, now open at Lincoln Land Community College in Springfield, at statewideshow.com. And coming up, why the Shawnee National Forest might soon charge admission to some of its more popular sites. More reports and conversations from in and around Illinois ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. One of the most scenic locations in Illinois is in the southern part of the state, the Shawnee National Forest. But the nearly 270,000-acre forest has a problem. Money is tight, and there's a backlog of deferred maintenance. So a plan has been put forth to charge those who visit the most popular parts of the forest. It would be a $5 per vehicle fee at six locations, including the Garden of the Gods Recreation Area Trail. Laura Lecker is the forest's Recreation, Engineering, and Lands Staff Officer, and she joined me to talk about it. You've had this proposal in front of the public for a while now. What feedback have you heard so far?
We've actually had very good input so far. Some people are for it. Some people are against it. We've had some good suggestions of possible ways to adjust it or add some ideas to it. We've still got another month to go, a little over, for public comment, so we hope it continues to come in.
So let's go into why the need to implement a charge.
Well, over the past 5 to 10 years, our agency-wide, our recreation budgets have been flat to slightly declining. There have been, you know, better years where we got a little more, other years when we got less. But the general trend is downward. And all of our insight that our agency has from the folks that work in Washington and that track these things is that this is going to continue. Well, at the same time, of course, everybody knows that the cost of business doing business just keeps going up a little bit every year. On top of that, our facilities, our recreation facilities, are all getting older. Most of them were built anywhere between the 60s and the 80s. You get older buildings, they start needing more and more help and maintenance.
I know a lot of people may think that when we're talking about some place as remote as the Shawnee Forest, you know, they're thinking, what facilities, what are we talking about here? Are you talking about buildings? Are you talking about campground sites? What are some of the needs? Where are they at?
Well, they're at our developed recreation sites. And when we say developed, we mean that, yes, there's some sorts of structures there. There's one campground that's included in the current fee proposal for a fee increase. The other six sites are day-use sites, no overnight camping allowed at the individual sites. But they all have bathroom facilities. They have parking areas, most of them paved. They have interpretive signs. They have directional signs that tell people, you know, where they're going and how to get to specific trails or sites. In some cases, they have water or electric. But the big thing is the structures. Those are things that over time have to be repaired or replaced, and that costs money.
Is an idea such as this, a fee to access some of these sites, is that common in other locations, other national forests?
Yes, sir. Most national forests, I can't give you a precise statistics on it, but most national forests do have some sites that are fee sites. I know that our closest neighbors, the Mark Twain National Forest and the Hoosier National Forest, both have some day-use fee sites. Campgrounds, everybody kind of gets that. They're almost always fee sites if they're developed. But as I said, we also have a lot of day-use sites that have fees.
Just make sure I'm clear. It's $5 per vehicle and maybe an annual pass. That's what's being looked at right now?
The basics of the fee as proposed. There's a possibility that it could be adjusted, probably down, if we changed it before the proposal is finalized. But the proposal is $5 for a vehicle, doesn't matter how many people you've crammed into that vehicle, at one of the day-use sites for that day. The annual pass would be an alternative available for people who visit these sites a lot.
So the earliest this could take effect, if everything goes as planned, would be sometime next year, is that correct?
If everything goes as planned, and that's always a big if, it would go, the proposal would go to the advisory committee in the spring, they look at it, make a recommendation to our regional forester, who would make the final decision. If the decision is to implement a fee, the change will begin July 1st of 2020.
I'm sure you've heard from some people who are not fans of this idea, who feel as though, you know, they already pay taxes. They, you know, pay for what they would consider upkeep of the forest. Their tax money does go toward that. And then, of course, you have some people who feel as though it would be onerous to have to pay that extra fee. Maybe they can't afford to pay the additional amount. Is that something that the Forest Service has considered in this proposal?
We have, and it's certainly both of those points come up in some of the comments that we receive. And with regards to the tax question, yes, the American public, American taxpayers pay for their national forest system, but the funding isn't always getting to us at the level we need it. And so we have to look at some other alternatives. And we have other things that we do as well. We use volunteer support when you can get volunteers to go out and help. We have a friends group that does some fundraising for us. But it's all little stuff, and we have to try to add it up. In the event of a fee, it's only the people who are utilizing the sites who have to pay. In some ways, I consider it more fair, because if you're the one utilizing it, you're the one who's also, one, in need of those facilities, and two, you're impacting those facilities.
Laura Lecker is with the Shawnee National Forest, and she joined us here on Statewide. At least two more public comment hearings are planned surrounding the fee proposal. If you don't make it to those, you can always weigh in on the forest's website. A link is at statewideshow.com. And that's not the only controversy surrounding the National Forest. The U.S. Forest Service is planning to open a portion of the Shawnee, about 500 acres, to commercial logging. The Forest Service says it's part of ecological restoration and that it would clear an area that needs disruption to improve the health of other trees and species. But environmental activists are lining up for a fight similar to one that happened a few decades ago when protests over a similar plan were common. We'll continue to follow that issue as well. Well, earlier this month in southern Illinois, in the tiny town of Macanda, an event was held called Vulture Fest. It featured music and artisans, and the name is inspired by the number of vultures who congregate there in the fall. While the scavenger birds play an important role in the ecosystem, some are posing a problem for Midwest livestock producers. Megan Feeney has more details.
Driving her off-road vehicle through the pasture, Donna Bescher points to a black feathered form hanging from the branch of a persimmon tree.
Look right up in there, in that tree. That's one of the effigies. The only thing that supposedly a buzzard is afraid of is another dead buzzard.
She and her husband asked the federal government for an effigy because they're among the growing population of farmers who say black vultures are attacking calves and sometimes mother cows. Donna and Charlie Bescher run cattle in two southeast Missouri counties and say the birds target soft tissues until a calf succumbs or must be put down. Producers lament the monetary loss, which can average $1,000 per calf, but they also grieve the violence of the death and the wasted time and effort.
There's nothing more gut-wrenching than a fresh-born baby with its eyes ripped out, bawling. They either rip the navel out or their eyes, it'll bring you to tears.
Jeff Reed is growing his cattle operation in nearby Wayne County. He was excited about a newborn calf that had the same markings as its mother and what it meant for the future.
That one tore at me pretty good because, you know, that's the genetics you want to move forward, and then you come back and that's stripped away.
Black vultures have a 5-foot wingspan and weigh about 4 pounds. Some bird conservationists express skepticism that black vultures depredate livestock, but black vulture populations have been increasing and expanding their range in the U.S. to include southern parts of Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri. It's likely that's happening because of warmer winters or the construction of cell phone towers, which make excellent roosting sites. Black vultures are protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, but a $100 kill permit is available through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Dan McMurtry, with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services, says producers wanting a kill permit can usually obtain one within a few days. But he suggests farmers move calving mother cows close to home, monitor them, and harass black vultures that threaten their animals. The Beschers, who lost 3 calves and a cow to black vultures last calving season, have adopted a multi-tactical defense. Among their harassment techniques,
ready?
Pyrotechnics. Charlie Bescher believes producers could benefit from more official outreach and education and a simplified permit process.
Where you can pick up the phone, call your local USD agent, have a permit that day.
Other producers are sticking with the 3S approach: shoot, shovel, and shut up. People know black vultures do have benefits, but
what farmers and other people here within the United States aren't thinking about is our vulture population is healthy. We need to keep it that way.
That's Don Grifford, the executive director of World Bird Sanctuary in Valley Park, Missouri. She says in Africa and Asia, poisoning has collapsed vulture populations, creating dire public health consequences because vultures have the ability to process deadly diseases like botulism, leprosy, and rabies, and dead end the pathogens. Grifford thinks vultures are unfairly blamed and points to a lack of real-time recorded evidence of black vulture attacks on livestock. But Charlie Bescher says documentation is not a priority for a producer who finds a vulture on their calf.
We're getting a gun out. It's not a camera. We're getting a gun because there's nobody going to sit there and watch that happen to their animal.
Farmers and bird conservationists agree. Black vultures are smart. On the farm, the birds set up roost in anticipation of calving season. The Beschers think turkey vultures have been studying, too. One recent afternoon, Charlie discovered one tearing on the unhealed umbilical cord of a live newborn calf. The calf died 4 hours later. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Megan Feeney.
Just in time for Halloween, two men have published a book about the supernatural in one area of the state. It's called Ghosts of the Quad Cities. Herb Trix has more details.
Separately and together, Michael McCarty and Mark McLaughlin have written poetry, short stories, and books, and worked for magazines, websites, and the Sci-Fi Channel. But Ghosts of the Quad Cities is their first nonfiction collaboration. McCarty says it all started when he organized a seance for local parents by the amazing Kreskin.
And where we did the seance was at this place called Pi Kappa Chi, because they're haunted. And so when Kreskin was there doing the seance, it was pretty creepy. And the reason that we had that place was because I did a lot of research at that time about different haunted places in the Quad Cities, and that was like the number one hot spot.
McCarty says they didn't want to imitate those TV shows where the hosts either want to disprove any possibility of a supernatural presence or they believe it all totally.
Both Mark and I have a journalistic background. We took it as an investigation, like a news story. We went there and almost presented it like if you're doing a case, a judge, you presented this to a judge and jury. We took the evidence. We let the readers kind of decide if they think it's ghost or not ghost. We just present it in a very fair fashion.
McLaughlin says he enjoyed learning about local history, especially when it involved a mystery and something that couldn't be explained.
We might have came across things that suggested a mischievous presence. Well, we never came across anything that suggested a horrific or malignant or evil presence. No, we didn't. You know, nobody got snatched up into the sky or torn up or, you know, nobody was vomiting pea soup around.
So what was the most haunted spot? The one with the strongest presence of something? Well, it's near Monmouth, Illinois, and called Crybaby Bridge. He calls it oddly vibrant.
Because all haunted places, they have their legends. And the particular legend with the Crybaby Bridge is if you park your car on the bridge, you'll roll a little ways. Even if you put it in neutral and just sit there, suddenly it'll start rolling. Not very fast, but it did inch forward while we were in it.
And also, you're supposed to put talcum powder on the bumper. And then when you're done, when it pushes it across the bridge, it's supposed to leave fingerprints or handprints on the back of the bumper. We didn't see that. But
yeah, we didn't see that.
There are different legends about why there might be a presence at Crybaby Bridge, but none that really held up after their investigation. McCarty also vividly remembers his visit to the basement of the Source bookstore in downtown Davenport.
So I went down there, and I was kind of looking around. And it's kind of a dark basement. I kind of looked around at all the corners. And I went around, and there was this big furnace in the corner. And I was, like, looking at it, and it just kind of kicked in like that. Then it stopped, and it kind of freaked me out. I go, oh, logically, it didn't really make a lot of sense because this is during the middle of summer. So I go, oh, the owner probably turned on to scare me. So I go up there, and they said, well, did you see anything? So I says, yeah, the furnace kicked in. He goes, that furnace has been disconnected for years.
Other sites they investigated for their book range from hotels and college buildings to a hospital and the Rock Island Arsenal.
Now, I'm an eternal optimist. I see the bright side of everything. And to me, the belief in an afterlife is I think, a manifestation of humanity's optimism. Because as far as we all know, at some point, we'll all end up deceased. And I think it would be rather sad if every one of us just flicked out like a candle. It would be nice to think that there is something beyond just dying that kind of makes a person feel like, ah, there is a reward for living my life in a good way.
Ghosts of the Quad Cities is available through the History Press. I'm Herb Trix.
A spooky end to this week statewide. All of our episodes are available at our website at statewideshow.com, and our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. We're glad you could join us, and be sure to be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.